You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
Next, we rejoin Mike McCormick as he takes a look at the systemic manipulation of elections in the United States, as he speaks with Stephen Hill of the Center for Voting and Democracy, who's the author of a new book, Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics.
If you could give a brief bio of yourself and the Center for Voting and Democracy.
Okay. The Center for Voting and Democracy is a nonprofit educational and research organization that specializes in voting systems and ways to empower voters to increase representation, participation, and better methods of governance. And we're 10 years old. John Anderson, who is a former presidential candidate and congressman, is the president of our organization.
And do you primarily just focus on voting here in the U.S.?
Yes, primarily we focus on voting in the U.S., but we do research into voting methods used in other countries, proportional representation, cumulative voting, single transferable vote, choice voting systems like this. We also do a lot of research into the redistricting process and the impact of voting systems on campaign finance reform and term limits and some of the other reforms that have been promoted over the last decade or so.
Your book has an interesting title, Fixing Elections. Tell us about that.
The title of my book is Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics. And the title, Fixing Elections, is deliberately provocative. There's kind of a double meaning there. One is fixing elections as in offering some solutions, which my book does do, but also it's fixing elections in the sense that our elections are rigged in a certain way, that when you look at, for instance, like the redistricting practices that we have, whereby the incumbents get to draw their own district lines, and in this most recent redistricting that just occurred, as many have been saying, it's the worst incumbent protection plans they've seen ever. You have states like California where, as one congresswoman said, all the incumbents paid $20,000 to the political consultant who was redrawing the district lines to draw them a safe seat, a seat that they could win in without really even running for re-election. As a result of that, out of 53 congressional seats in California, only one of them is competitive, is up for grabs. All the others are done deals. You know, the voters don't even have to show up in those elections because they've already been, the lines have been rigged to determine who's going to win, either Democrat or Republican. And then you look at, for instance, our presidential election that we had in November 2000, everybody knew that there was only about 8 or 9 states that were up for grabs. All the other states, plus the District of Columbia, were all done deals. They were safe states for one party, one candidate, or the other. And so when you think about all the money that's raised and that kind of thing in the presidential election, it was all being targeted at just these handful of states. And then not only that, but they don't even have to talk to all the voters in those handful of states. They know within each state that there's certain voters that they can take for granted and others that they're never going to have a chance of winning their vote. So if it's a Democratic candidate, they know, well, the Democratic voters are going to vote for me, and the Republican candidates, they're not going to vote for me, so I don't have to worry about them. They target their message at a very small segment of voters within those states, you know, maybe 10 to 15% of voters who are undecided. And so what should be a national campaign in a presidential election really boils down to the most provincial of considerations are just a handful of voters and a handful of swing states that determine our presidential elections. And so in that sense, that's just two examples, and I go into many others in my book. In that sense, the elections really are rigged in a sense, in the sense that for many voters, they're witnessing these elections as if they're just bystanders on the sidelines because the candidates aren't talking to them. They aren't addressing their issues because most voters don't fit into this small category of swing voters who determine elections in our winner-take-all system.
In your book, you point out that our current winner-take-all system is the very same system that we started out with at the beginning of this country. Can you give us a sense of history of that and where things changed during that time period?
Sure. The winner-take-all voting system is what we've always used. It's in the book, it's what I call 18th century democracy technology. And in that sense, it's as outdated as something else from the 18th century might be, particularly in the current climate where they have really sophisticated technology for conducting politics today. So they use, for instance, in the redistricting process, very advanced computers and software and databases that allow them to really carve their districts up into a very personalized district for each incumbent. And so the technology has reached a point where, you know, we like to think that on the first Tuesday in November, we go to the voters' booth and pick our representatives. But in fact, the politicians are picking us. And they're doing that through the redistricting process with these highly sophisticated technologies and computers. And that's relatively new in this redistricting process. So there's always been a certain amount of gerrymandering that went on in our redistricting process and in our winner-take-all system. But the use of computers to really, really carve it up in such a precise way and really decide whose votes are going to count and whose are not, that's fairly new. The other thing that's new in terms of the technologies being used in the winner-take-all system have to do with the ways we campaign today. Today, because they can figure out exactly which districts are competitive and which are not, and they can figure out which states are competitive and which are not, that means they can use things like polling and focus groups and dial meter groups and 30-second TV spots to really precisely target their message to only a handful of voters in these swing states. And by doing this, all the other issues that other voters care about are left on the sidelines. So to give you an example, in the November 2000 presidential election, both sides had figured out that the swing voters in that election were basically seniors who were a better than average income and who lived in just a handful of states. And so the issues that they were talking about, we might recall, were issues like Social Security, prescription drugs, Medicare, all these sorts of things, ones that affected these seniors, who most of them who had higher than average income. So as a result of this, what should have been a national election boiled down to just these handful of voters being spoken to. And so voters like young voters, for instance, or Washington Post did a series on poor people in Pennsylvania, which was a swing state, so you'd think that their vote would matter. And in fact, those voters, even in a swing state, poor voters, their votes really didn't matter. The candidates didn't talk to them, didn't address their issues, and they felt left out of the political process. So when you're looking at things like voter turnout and participation, how we campaign today and who the candidates choose to talk to by using these modern technologies like polling and focus groups and what have you really is having a huge impact on whether voters feel engaged and feel like they have any connection to the politicians who are running for the office.
So it sounds like they kind of select specific groups, they incense and get a certain segment of the population irate enough to go to the polls, and then at the same time they're also ignoring or disempowering other people that could affect the vote as well, disempowering them enough to keep them away from the polls.
Exactly. And so what that means is when it comes down to a two-party, two-candidate system, is that winning is what's called a zero-sum game. If I win, you lose. If I can drive voters away from you, the only choice left is me. So you use the polling and the focus groups to figure out which message are going to drive voters away from your opponent and which message will at least give them a warm, fuzzy feeling about you as a candidate. And so that becomes your political campaign. You're targeting this small slice of swing voters, and everyone else is sliced and diced out of the political process, and then you use negative campaigning and mudslinging to whatever extent that you can to drive the swing voters away from your opponent. And that basically describes our political campaign practices. And so, you know, a presidential election should be a time of when the nation is considering the great issues of our times and voters are most engaged, and instead it's becoming anything but. It's become essentially cotton candy for the, you know, the handful of swing voters. And I should add that one political consultant described swing voters as those voters who are least engaged in politics, have the least interest or knowledge about it, and if you can't grab them in 8 seconds or less, you've lost them. So these are the voters that all the plays are made to, and these are the voters that essentially determine the winners in close races in our winner-take-all political system.
And as we saw in the last presidential election, the continuing phenomenal increase in the amount of money that's going into these, where is that money going? Is it going just to these political consultants and these companies that produce the software that does the redistricting?
Well, the techniques of campaigning today with using polling and focus groups and dial meter groups are incredibly expensive, and it does require all these professionals and these sorts of things. To give you an example, when Bob Dole gave his 1996 acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention, beneath the floor of the convention was a cavernous hall in which they had all these dial meter groups. And what a dial meter group is you bring into a room a bunch of people who are undecided voters, and you have them listen to a speech or watch a commercial, and they sit there with a dial. And if they like what they're hearing, they crank their dial all the way to the right in the high zones. And if they don't like what they're hearing, they crank it all the way to the left in the low zones. And by doing this, they amass this information. Not only do they have them below the floor of the convention, but they also had them hooked up in Atlanta and Detroit and a couple of other cities. And they were basically finding out which words and which concepts got a rise out of people and made them, you know, excited or turned off to what the candidate was saying. These kind of practices are being used all the time, and they're rather Orwellian, really, and when you think about it. I mean, they're basically, you know, using these techniques to figure out what words and what concepts will sell to you what they want to do. Because some have said, well, if they're doing these polling and focus groups, they really want to know what voters have to say, so maybe that means they're being more accountable. But two researchers have found, no, not at all. Instead, what they're doing is they are using these techniques to do what they call crafted talk and simulated responsiveness. They are finding out what words and concepts will allow them to do what they want to do and basically sell the voters a bill of goods. You know, it's kind of like a used car salesperson would do. So these are the techniques that are going on in our winner-take-all system, and the winner-take-all system makes them much more effective because when there's only two candidates running in most races, as I said, you use these techniques to drive voters away from your opponent, which is much easier to do when you have a two-choice system like we have.
If we could stick with this redistricting for a little bit, basically how is redistricting done? Who's making the choices on this? Why isn't there any citizen input on it?
The redistricting process in most states is a travesty of democracy. You have the incumbents and the party leaders who basically have just a couple of incentives. One is to guarantee their own reelection, and two is to guarantee the reelection of as many of their colleagues and try to win control of the legislatures. That's basically what's going on in redistricting. And the impact on voters is not taken into consideration at all. So they're not concerned about the fact that once this process is over, as we just saw, most seats at that point are safe seats and done deals, and voters have really no choice except to ratify the candidate of the party that dominates the district that has been drawn to produce that result. And this also has huge implications for campaign finance reform because, you know, a lot of times people say, well, money buys elections. But in fact, the impacts of redistricting trump the impacts of money hands down. Once you've drawn the district to make it so lopsided that only a Democrat can win this district or only a Republican can win this district over here, at that point, the role of money in those elections is really subsidiary. In fact, the donors at that point are giving money to the candidates they know are going to win because the district has been drawn to produce that result. So the donors at that point are buying access, not elections. It's a subtle difference, but it's an important difference that we really have to understand if we want to be able to truly reform our system. So these districts are being drawn in such a way as to basically make voters' votes not really count for much. When you show up to the voters' booth, it's already a done deal. The other aspect of it that's going on is that the party leaders are sort of sitting back like military generals looking at the political map. And they're able to say, okay, this district over here, we know we've got that one won. We don't have to spend any money. This other district over here, we don't have a chance over there. Let's not spend any money or any resources over there. Let's raise all this money and focus it like a laser on just these handful of districts. And so you have incumbents like, you know, where I live in San Francisco, Nancy Pelosi, who doesn't need to spend a dime to win re-election. She wins with 80% of the vote. She's a Democrat in a very liberal city. And yet she still raises millions of dollars. And so you say, well, what does she do with this money? Well, she takes this money and she gives it to colleagues in closer races. And by doing that, she buys their allegiance when it comes time to vote for a party caucus leadership. So she's now the House Minority Whip for the Democratic Party. And so by doing this, the real impact of our money is that it creates these kind of political machines. It's almost kind of a pyramidal shape to all our politics where these incumbents raise money that they don't need for their own reelections. They give it to colleagues in close races. And by doing that, they buy themselves committee chairpersons, subcommittees, and what have you. And they become the chairs of all these different committees and subcommittees. So that's really the fuller anecdote of what's going on in our political system and how it really is being distorted, not only by money, but also by the redistricting process, which is, of course, part and parcel of our winner-take-all political system.
So is there a commission that decides the redistricting for, let's say, in your area?
No, redistricting is, it pretty much proceeds just like any other legislative bill. The party caucus, the party that controls the legislature, decides redistricting. So in California, for instance, the Democrats controlled redistricting because they control both houses of the state legislature as well as the governor's seat. So they got to redraw the district lines. And so they work with a political consultant who gets on the computer and looks at the demographics and where Democratic voters live, where Republican voters live. And basically they start carving up the district in a way to make as many seats for the Democratic Party as they can. And then they introduce it as a legislative bill. It's passed by both of the houses of the legislature and then signed by the governor. Now, in states where one party doesn't control both houses and the governor's seat, then you have a bit of a split. And sometimes, oftentimes, it can end up in court. And then the courts will draw the district lines. And, you know, that can be less of a political process, but then it's a matter of which way the court tilts ideologically often, and they decide which lines will be used. And this power of drawing the lines is really a godlike power. Once you've drawn those district lines and they last for the next 10 years, there's really not much chance that another party is going to be able to win a district drawn for the opposite party. And as a result of that, like in the last couple of election cycles, for instance, three-quarters of the races were won by landslides of 60% to 40% or higher, and 91% of the seats were won by non-competitive margins of 55% to 45% or higher. So you're looking at a situation where the parties are rigging the district lines in order to guarantee themselves as many seats as they can.
Can you name any of the companies that do the software that do the redistricting? Is it a handful of companies, or is it like one? Do you know?
Oh, there's different vendors out there that produce the software for drawing these districts. There's one called GeoVoter, and there's others out there. Not only do you get the software for drawing the district lines, but they also come loaded with all the demographic data you need already loaded in with, like, race, partisanship, gender, all these sorts of things. So you can really start, you know, you draw a map on your computer screen, and immediately it'll tell you what the demographics of that district is. And the technology has become extremely sophisticated. You know, in Texas, the Republican Party, Tom DeLay in particular, was giving laptops to all the Republican incumbents to work with political consultants to draw the districts as they wanted them. And, you know, you can do it all on a laptop computer today, and it's really quite amazing what you can do.
I think it would be safe to say that a lot of Americans realize that there's something seriously wrong with our electoral system, but most people don't know how do we go about fixing this, and you have a lot of good ideas on that, and I'm wondering if you can tell us some of those.
Well, the way to get a handle on the defects of our winner-take-all voting system is to start to move away from this system that we've been using for 200 years, and there's a few ways that we can do that. One, at the very minimum, we should take redistricting out of the hands of the incumbent politicians. Having them drawing their own district lines is like allowing the fox to guard the hen house. It's like allowing all the accountants and these corporate executives who, you know, have recently gotten in trouble with Enron and all this kind of stuff. There basically was no one with oversight on them, and so they could do whatever they wanted to. The same thing is happening in the redistricting process. Basically, those who should be overseeing and making sure it's done fairly are actually drawing the lines themselves and feathering their own nests. So the first thing we'd do would be to take redistricting out of the hands of the politicians. In a few states like Iowa and Arizona recently passed a voters initiative in which they created a nonpartisan independent commission that draws the district lines instead of allowing the incumbents to do it. So that's step one. Step two would be to change the winner-take-all system entirely to what is known as proportional representation voting systems. And with proportional representation voting systems, you don't use single-seat districts for the most part. You use what's called multi-seat districts, so that if a political party, for instance, gets 10% of the vote in a 10-seat district, they get 1 out of 10 of those seats. If they get 30% of the vote in a 10-seat district, they get 3 out of 10 of those seats. So by doing it this way, you don't have to redistrict. You don't have to draw the lines in any way. And also it means that suddenly you have a multi-party democracy. You have Democrats and Republicans getting elected, but you also have maybe a Green Party winning some legislative seats, or maybe a Reform Party or Libertarian Party. So suddenly you have more choice for voters instead of the voters being bunkered down in these safe, non-competitive, basically feudalistic kind of fiefdoms of the incumbents, suddenly voters have choice. So you see in these proportional representation democracies like they use in Europe quite a lot, you see much higher voter turnout. So instead of getting the 38% voter turnout as we had in our last congressional elections, you get, you know, 75, 80, 85, some of them have over 90% voter turnout for their national legislative elections. So because voters have more choice and more voters see their votes count for more, there's more incentive to turn out to vote.
Yeah, you have to find it somewhat ironic that for the country that holds itself as the example of democracy for the rest of the world, that we have one of the lowest turnouts, you know, on the planet.
Yeah, voter turnout in the United States is reaching truly alarming proportions. We're seeing an increase in single-digit voter turnouts all across the nation. When I was writing the book, I started compiling these numbers, and I was astounded because no one has really quite compiled them in this way. In fact, it's hard to get voter turnout statistics for local government elections and even state government elections sometimes. It's almost like we don't want to keep track of it because it's too embarrassing. But we're seeing, for instance, in a recent Dallas mayoral race, so electing the mayor, the highest office in the city, 5% voter turnout. Charlotte, North Carolina for city council, 7% voter turnout. Primary in Virginia for the state attorney general, which is the highest law enforcement office in the state, it was about 8% voter turnout. Lawrence, Massachusetts was, again, single-digit voter turnout. School board elections are, you know, just getting lower and lower, single-digit voter turnouts. And then we're seeing other turnouts in the teens and the 20s. In California, in Los Angeles County, there are seven cities where there were no candidates to oppose the safe seat incumbents, and so they canceled the elections, which you can do under California law if there's no one contesting the elections. So I think this is pretty alarming, and a lot of people are only beginning to realize how bad it's gotten. We know that at the national level it's been low. Presidential election in 1996 was the lowest in 70 years. Less than a majority of voters turned out to vote, and in 2000, just barely over a majority of voters turned out to vote. And so people are starting to try to figure out what can we do about it. And they're looking at just about everything except for the winner-take-all voting system. And really, one of the theses of my book is that the winner-take-all voting system is at the root of a lot of this low voter turnout, because voters simply don't have any choice. There's nothing to motivate them to go to the polls. Most voters are locked down in these safe seat, non-competitive districts where they've been drawn to re-elect the incumbent. And all they're really doing is ratifying the candidate of the party that dominates their district. That's the only choice for most voters that they have. I mean, this is no better than the old Soviet Union system where the Politburo was elected in purely symbolic elections. And it's really, it's getting that bad in this country. So when you're looking at low voter turnout, you have to look at the fact that most races are not competitive, and the fact that for most candidates, even if they're in a close race, then they're looking at these swing voters, just a handful of voters, and they're targeting their message to a handful of voters instead of talking to everyone in the election, all the voters in the election, and the rest of the voters are pretty much being left on the political sidelines with their issues unaddressed.
So how do we implement some of these solutions that you're proposing, like, let's say, proportional representation? Do you do it at a city, county, state level? How do you even go against something like the federal side of it?
There's nothing in the U.S. Constitution that prevents us from changing our winner-take-all political system to proportional representation. So basically all you have to do is change the applicable local, state, and federal laws. To change your city council, for instance, to proportional representation, you just have to change your city charter. And a few years ago in Seattle, there was a group that began collecting signatures to put on the ballot a charter amendment that would change city council elections to proportional representation. So that's what you can do for a local level. For state level, you know, some states you have to change the state constitution. Others you can do it with just a change in state law. And so that means if you have the power of initiative in your state, you can do it by state initiative. And if you don't, then you have to basically get the incumbents to change the rules to reelect them, which could be somewhat difficult. So state initiatives would be the way to go, I would think, for the states to have that option. And then at the federal level, there's one federal law that was passed in 1967 to support the Voting Rights Act, which mandated single-seat districts for Congress. A lot of people don't realize that throughout our 200-year-plus history, we've gone back and forth between using single-seat districts and using at-large elections for the U.S. House. And so it's relatively new that we only use single-seat districts, and so we just would have to change that federal law to allow an option for proportional representation, and then states would be able to experiment on their own and elect their congressional delegations by proportional representation if they'd like. I would add that we actually use proportional representation in various ways in this country already. For instance, for the presidential elections, the candidates are nominated through a proportional representation process. Particularly the Democratic Party, each candidate goes to the National Nominating Convention with the percentage of delegates that matches their percentage of the popular vote in each state. That's a proportional allocation. And so we use that already for, you know, this most American of elections, nominating our presidential candidate. The Democrats do that in all their states, and the Republicans do that in about one-third of their states. So it's being used, but just most people don't recognize it.
And this seems to be something that doesn't get too much media coverage.
The media, unfortunately, in most instances, is really stuck in a winner-take-all mentality. The media not only doesn't report on the differences between, say, winner-take-all voting systems and proportional representation, but the winner-take-all media, as I call it in the book, actually shuts out candidates bringing new points of view and new perspectives into elections, which is to say that they're shutting out people who are giving information to voters. The media are pre-selecting which candidates will and will not be heard from by voters. And, of course, in most instances, that means they're shutting out third-party and independent candidates and only covering Democrats and Republicans. It's my belief that this should be looked upon as an in-kind donation to the Democratic and Republican candidates and should be recorded in all the FEC documents as such, and yet people don't really think of it that way. Now, the media's reason for not covering third-party candidates and independent candidates is that, well, they don't have a chance of winning. That's usually what they use as their reason. But in fact, as I point out in my book, because most districts and most elections are not competitive, you could also say that the Democrat or the Republican in one of those races, they don't have a chance of winning either. So, you know, in a very heavily Democratic district, the Republican doesn't have a chance of winning. And in a very heavily Republican district, the Democrat doesn't have a choice of winning. So if they were going to apply that standard fairly and across the board, they wouldn't hold any debate, so they wouldn't cover any of the candidates. So it's truly, when you start looking at their reasons, they're pretty transparent, and it's because they really do have this kind of allegiance to the duopoly, to the winner-take-all major parties, that prevents them from covering these minor party candidates, which, as I said, means that voters don't have information. Voters in Minnesota, when they elected Jesse Ventura, it was because Jesse Ventura had public financing of elections and was included in the televised debates. Otherwise, he would have suffered the same fate as all the other third-party candidates in this country who basically are unheard from and don't have a chance to make their case to the voters because the winner-take-all media shuts them out.
And real quick, are you optimistic at this point with all the stuff that's been happening that we might be able to turn this around?
It's my belief that change is coming in this country in terms of changing our voting system. It's coming slowly, but we're just seeing more and more dissatisfaction. And you look at what's going on right now in the national scene with Enron and, you know, WorldCom and all these false accounting practices and insider dealing. And people can see that something is extremely broken about our politics. But they're still learning to a large degree that the winner-take-all political system is really the engine of what's driving a lot of these problems. And so it's my belief, as more people understand the impact of our winner-take-all system, they're going to want change. And particularly when you look at our country, it's becoming an extremely racially diverse country. And the winner-take-all system is what's known as a zero-sum game system. If I win, you lose. One representative per district. And the districts are becoming so diverse that one representative can't possibly represent all the diversity within that district. And so we've had to sort of concoct truly a rather odd notion that defies second-grader logic, and that is that the person represents you just because they sit in the chair. Even if you didn't vote for that person, and even if you are diametrically opposed to their point of view, that somehow they still represent you. That's really odd when you stop and think about it. And yet you hear that kind of thing repeated ad nauseum by League of Women Voters types on talk radio and these sorts of things. And that's an odd notion to places that use proportional representation, where basically 90% of voters turn out, and 90% of those will vote for a winner, instead of in this country where, you know, maybe 34% will turn out, and of those, maybe half of those will vote for a winner. So I think people are starting to realize that in many ways the system just doesn't work, and as our nation becomes more racially diverse, you know, and like in inner cities, one race is winning representation and another is not, and it creates conflict and tension around the time of redistricting and redrawing these district lines, they're going to start seeking out more solutions, and they already are. And I think as more third-party candidates run, like you're seeing in Minnesota, where a Green Party candidate is challenging the progressive Democratic candidate, then suddenly people are seeing, well, this doesn't seem to work. Two parties that, you know, the progressive Democrats and Greens, who should be allies to some extent, are at each other's throats now, and they're starting to realize it's because of the voting system. The voting system is basically pitting themselves against each other, and if they were using something like instant runoff voting or proportional representation in Minnesota, then it wouldn't have to work that way. So it really is a matter of people starting to examine more of the problems of our system and searching for new solutions.
That was Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters in Seattle, speaking with Stephen Hill of the Center for Voting and Democracy about his new book, Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics.
Come on, you losing factory girls, I want you to understand. I'm gonna leave this factory and return to my native land. Sing dum-dee-wickety-dum-dee-way, I'm gonna go so far away. Dum-dee-wickety-dum-dee-way, I'm gonna leave this town someday. No more will I take my shaker and shawl and hurry to the mill. No more will I work so goddamn hard to earn a dollar bill. Sing dum-dee-wickety-dum-dee-way, I'm gonna go so far away. Dum-dee-wickety-dum-dee-way, I'm gonna leave this town someday. No more will I take my towel and soap and go to the sink and wash. No more the overseer will say you're making a terrible splash. Sing dum-dee-wickety-dum-dee-way, I'm gonna go so far away. Dum-dee-wickety-dum-dee-way, I'm gonna leave this town someday. No more will I take my comb and go to the glass to comb my hair. No more the overseer will say...
That was Ethan Miller singing Lewiston Factory Girl from his In Times of War CD, available from the artist by contacting Ethan at jedcenter.org. That's E-T-H-A-N, Ethan, at jedcenter, jedcenter.org. Next, People's Tribune Radio takes a look at the National Labor Relations Act and workers' rights. Mike Thornton introduces the program.
When it was passed in 1935 by the United States Congress, the National Labor Relations Act was heralded as the Magna Carta of labor. But is the NLRA now actually hurting workers? More and more people are saying yes. Jim Pope is a professor of law at Rutgers University. He was interviewed by PTR correspondent David Apsey at the Labor Party convention in Washington, D.C.
The National Labor Relations Act is the basic law that governs workers' rights to organize unions in the United States. It was passed in 1935, and at that time, it was a big victory for working people, because before that time, they had no right under federal law whatsoever to organize or strike, protest in any way. Now, what's happened over the years, however, is that whereas in 1935, when the National Labor Relations Act was passed, the labor movement was very mobilized and powerful and able to take advantage of this law and use it effectively, over the years, the protections have been whittled away, and corporations have figured out how to turn the provisions of the National Labor Relations Act against workers, so that now the law actually inhibits workers from exercising their rights to organize and strike. How this happened, in a word, there was, of course, the Taft-Hartley Act in 1946, which took away many protections of the National Labor Relations Act, had offered, and also outlawed workers supporting each other. And I want to give you an example of that because I think this is of central importance. It helps to explain why it's so hard for workers to organize today. And that is that before the Taft-Hartley Act, if an employer fired workers for organizing, other unions could support the workers at that employer's facility by refusing to handle its products. So, for example, let's say an employer like Walmart fires, which Walmart does all the time, discriminates against an employee who wants to organize a union at that store, then the employees at that store might ask the truckers not to transport Walmart products, or might ask workers at other facilities that have to that produce products for Walmart not to produce products for Walmart. In 1946, the Taft-Hartley Act prohibited all that, so that employees at other employers are basically forced to assist Walmart in denying workers their rights, to assist Walmart in continuing to make a profit in spite of the fact that Walmart is violating the workers' right to organize by discriminating against people who want to organize a union.
So Taft-Hartley was sort of an amendment to the NLRA? Or
part of the Taft-Hartley Act was a set of amendments to the National Labor Relations Act, and that was one of them.
Professor Pope addressed the issue of political activity.
One terrible problem over the years since Taft-Hartley is that ordinary political activity, like lobbying, contributing money to political candidates, has proven to be totally ineffective at winning labor law reform. Unfortunately, there's a reason for this that is extremely unlikely to disappear. And that reason is that both major parties, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, receive more money from corporations and very wealthy individuals than they do from unions. The Democrats receive a lot of money from unions and working people, but it's still not nearly as much as the Democrats receive from corporations and the wealthy. So that what you have is you have a Republican Party that knows exactly what it's doing. Its money is coming from the same source as its votes. It's aggressive about pursuing its agenda. And meanwhile, you have a Democratic Party that's getting its votes from one constituency and its money from another constituency. And that's why the Democrats always seem to be waffling, while the Republicans are confidently moving forward because their votes and their money are coming from the same source.
What results, then, is for all intents and purposes a one-party political system?
It is when the corporations are united. And they aren't always united, which is why ordinary people can win some victories. They can ally with some corporations against other corporations. But when all the corporations line up on the same side of an issue, which is true with workers' rights, it's one kind of issue where they line up together, and there have been statistical studies of this. For example, on minimum wage, not all corporations always line up the same on that, and that's one reason why we still have a minimum wage and occasionally even can raise it. But on an issue like workers' rights, they always line up, and there have been no real victories, significant victories in workers' rights for decades at the national level.
You're listening to People's Tribune Radio, our topic, the National Labor Relations Act. Later, we'll hear from co-chair of the Labor Party's Workers' Rights Campaign, Ed Bruno. But first, we continue with Jim Pope, professor of law at Rutgers University. He was interviewed by People's Tribune radio correspondent David Apsey.
What other tactics can be used then by the workers to either amend laws or make their own kind of laws?
I don't claim to be an expert on this. I'm sitting in a university with a tenured job, and I'm not taking the kind of risks that working people would have to take, I think, to fight this kind of denial of workers' rights that's going on. What I can say is that in the past, before the National Labor Relations Act, the labor movement had an approach toward this problem that did prove successful in those times. And those times had some similarities to our times now, in that employers felt free to discharge workers for organizing, and the government was really providing no effective assistance. The approach that the labor movement took in those days, and it was the approach of people as far apart as Samuel Gompers, who's known as a very conservative business unionist, and John L. Lewis, on the other hand, who in the later stages of his career became a militant advocate of industrial unionism, they took the position that workers enjoyed constitutional rights to organize, to strike, and to act in solidarity under the First and 13th Amendments to the United States Constitution. Unions and workers went out and exercised those rights in spite of the fact that at the time that meant they were risking discharge by employers, injunctions from courts, potentially imprisonment, and even violent retaliation from vigilantes and government troops. I'm not in a position to recommend that anybody go out and take those risks. All I can say is that, in my opinion, workers are justified if they decide to take such risks. Recently, we had a teacher strike in New Jersey, where teachers went out on strike in spite of state law that said that public employee strikes were illegal. They were railroaded in court, in my opinion. They were ordered back to work. And if you listen carefully to what they said, without the benefit of any legal instruction on their constitutional rights, they said they believed that what they were doing was right, that the school district should not have the right to dictate their terms and conditions of employment with no consent from them. And I think it's that sentiment that comes out sometimes in struggles like the one in, with the New Jersey teachers that that can serve as a focal point, perhaps, for calling attention to these abuses.
The section of the 13th Amendment you're talking about is that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist in the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. How is infringing on the rights to organize involuntary servitude?
What I'm going to give you is basically the argument that Sam Gompers and John L. Lewis used years ago, which to me seems equally valid today. If you're working for a corporation and you do not have the right to organize, to strike, or to act in solidarity, you have no power. You can be fired for any reason or no reason at all. You have to be in a constant fear, and this is, you know, polls show this. Most American workers in polls say they believe that if they speak up to try to organize a union, they're going to get fired or otherwise discriminated against. You have no power, no effective voice, and so you're in a condition of servitude, on which I could say just parenthetically that the law used to not mince words about this. Labor law used to be called master and servant law. Now it's been sanitized, and it's called employment law. But they used to understand that that's exactly what it was, and the definition of an employee was the employee was a person who had to follow the orders of the master. Now, you might say, well, how can this possibly be involuntary servitude, given that you can quit your job You can quit your job and do something else. So it seems like it would be voluntary. Well, not if the only other thing you can do is go get another job, and then on that other job, you don't have the rights to organize, to strike, to act in solidarity. Because once again, if you don't have those rights, you're not going to have any power. You're going to be right back in a relation of servitude, so that the right to quit really boils down to a right to choose your master. But you can't choose to get out of a condition of servitude. That's the argument in brief. And of course, as with any legal argument, there are many, many ramifications of that, and we have a paper that tries to address those. The Labor Party, and again, I'm probably not the best person to ask this question of, because my involvement has been very much focused on this workers' rights project, and there are other people who have a much better understanding of the overall role of the party. But in terms of workers' rights, I think that the party can help to revive within the labor movement the tradition that existed before the Taft-Hartley Act, where workers and unions can take their own position on what the Constitution says. It means going back to the basic reason why we have a written Constitution, which is that you can read the Constitution. Everybody can read the Constitution, not just judges. And if you look at the way the constitutional rights have come into being, they have not come into being because of judges. If you look at the First Amendment, it wasn't even enforced until the 1920s, and not really enforced until even later than that. The reason being that it wasn't until the 20th century that people began stepping forward, reading the First Amendment for themselves and saying, we believe we have the right to free speech, and standing up and exercising that right, challenging the courts to take seriously the freedom of speech. And it took decades of that kind of activity, and people were getting thrown in jail merely for making speeches on street corners before the Supreme Court finally scratched its head and said, gee, maybe it really does mean free speech there in the First Amendment. And I think the process for workers' rights, really, it's already been through once, culminating in the initial enactment of the NLRA, which purports to protect the right to organize. It's eroded away over the intervening years. And now I think the Labor Party can play a role in reviving that kind of spirit that workers and unions can read the Constitution for themselves and exercise their rights.
Jim Pope, professor of law at Rutgers University, spoke with PT radio correspondent David Apsey at the Labor Party convention held in Washington, D.C. this past July. You are listening to People's Tribune Radio. I'm Mike Thornton. On this edition of PTR, we're looking at the National Labor Relations Act and workers' rights. The Labor Party has several campaigns that it's working on, one of those being workers' rights. Ed Bruno co-chairs the workers' rights campaign for the Labor Party. He also spoke with David Apsey at the Labor Party convention in Washington, D.C. Ed Bruno.
The experience of those of us who have been trying to organize unions for the last 30 years is fundamentally that the law has such an imbalance built right into it that when people are fired for exercising what ought to be their rights, nothing much happens except these long, drawn-out proceedings and investigations and judicial administrative hearings and so forth. But when workers do something that is effective, let's say have a picket line that actually stops the operation of a company, then the board acts immediately and there's injunctions and if you persist, there's police. So that embedded right in the core of the law is the problem that the law really is about regulating the free flow of commerce, and it's not really about the rights of workers. So it starts with the idea that business should not be interrupted, and that consequently certain rights should be accorded to working people in the interest of not interrupting business. So consequently, you don't get anywhere near the urgency. If you're simply fired because you want to have a form an association or bargain a contract, there's no urgency there because there's no interruption with business. And so that the imbalance is really the source of why the law can't work.
The law seemed to be a victory when it was passed in, 1935?
And in fact, it was. I mean, we got to look at this. You have to have a clear-eyed view of history here. And a lot of people sometimes they think, well, the law was the cause of the upsurge in industrial unionism, you know, the CIO and so forth. That's not true. On the other hand, other people say, well, the law had nothing to do with the upsurge in union organization. That's not true either. And if you look very carefully at the history of my own union, the UE, and steel, and auto, rubber, packing house, and the CIO in general, you'll find, in fact, that the breakthrough in organization had to do with the sit-downs in 1937, when the law was not in effect. And that was the breakthrough, and there was 5 months of sit-down strikes all over the country, and that established the unions, not in a majority position, but in a minority position. On the other hand, the second breakthrough came roughly in 39 to 41, and then the aggressive enforcement of the Wagner Act by the brand new NLRB was crucial. And they were, as an example, the brand new NLRB, which then was on the side of working people, returned 7,000 fired workers to just the Ford River Rouge plant alone. And of course, that solidified the union at Ford. So that the law, you got to be very careful and draw the lessons from what happened in this Wagner Act.
Could you explain what the Wagner Act is and how did the Wagner Act affect the NLRA?
Well, the Wagner Act is the NLRA. The Wagner Act and the National Labor Relations Act is the name of it is the Wagner Act after Senator Wagner. But you know, again, without making a big deal out of it, there was a long period of time when people tried to figure out how to bring some measure of democracy to the workplace, particularly the industrial workplace, which had no unions and no collective bargaining. And from a variety of events that happened in the New Deal days, the culmination of that was the Wagner Act, which we call the National Labor Relations Act, which created then the National Labor Relations Board. The thing I think that's vital to remember is the act was made constitutional in 1937. By 1938, the Supreme Court had already wiped out fundamentally the most important part of the act, which was that the Supreme Court ruled that even though the act said people have the right to strike, the Supreme Court said, but you can be replaced in the interest of the uninterrupted flow of business. So, you know, we've gone through the Supreme Court stuff a couple times, most recently in Florida. You know, they put a judicial interpretation on rights as they see them, depending on their class position. And as far as I know, there's no workers on the Supreme Court. Remember, the Wagner Act was based on the free flow of commerce, leaving itself open, therefore, to the Supreme Court to say, in the interest of free flow of commerce, strikers are to be able to be replaced by business so that business can operate. Our position today in the Labor Party is we've got to rethink this whole question and place those rights squarely on the Constitution so that the Supreme Court has a much more difficult time, or any court, in overthrowing workers' rights.
So now you're going to proceed from the position of the First and 13th Amendments is a constitutionally protected protections of freedom of speech, which gives you right to organize,
yes.
And 13th Amendment, freedom from involuntary servitude. Can you expand on this?
Well, the 13th is crucial to this thinking, where you know people aren't going to be used to this problem because we don't think very much about the 13th except in terms of slavery. But it's always been labor's position, at least up until the New Deal days, that to have effective rights of association and to effectively bargain, you have to be able to peacefully engage in things like strikes, sympathy, boycotts, and a whole variety of things that people should have a perfect right to do, and mostly in other countries do have a right to do. That's where the 13th becomes important. If you cannot effectively negotiate your conditions of employment, then you are, in fact, in a condition of involuntary servitude. And that was labor's position from the early 1900s, well into the New Deal. And then, of course, the CIO and the Wagner Act changed that for a while. But as we know, people cannot engage in collective bargaining today. They're not free to do so. They're not free to act in solidarity. So we think it's probably time to look back at our history and pick up that particular piece of constitutional rights as opposed to regulations.
So what strategies can be enacted by the working people to bring the program of the working people to the forefront here?
That is a $64 question. Right? This isn't going to be a very sexy answer, but I'll use myself as an example. I mean, I was a former director of organization of a pretty aggressive union, the UE, which aggressively organizes, and I'm in my mid-50s. And I'm only coming to this understanding of where the problems lie and how we envision our rights now. And part of this problem is my generation of trade union activists have lived our entire life under the NLRA, and we really don't know any better. We think that's the way it is, and things have really gone into decline for working people, and we can't quite figure out parts of the elements that would be needed for a revival. So consequently, our thinking is that we really don't have any business going to allies and so forth until we in the trade union movement get our own thinking straight on this question. So we're spending a lot of time talking to those trade unionists, particularly those who are in charge of organizing, bargaining, organizing strikes and so forth, about recapturing this history and then making an analysis of what that would mean for how we act. And we think we got to get our own house in order, so to speak, or at least a part of our own house, before we can give really significant public voice to this. So it's a lot of, it's not exactly underground work, but it's a lot of talking, a lot of discussing, a lot of thinking about our own experiences, what we can learn from them, and so forth. This is really a vital role for the Labor Party because it's here. It provides the format in which we can first of all develop this analysis and get people to help us with looking at our own history, and then the party, because it isn't one sector or just one union or something, can bring this to a cross-union audience, and that becomes crucial.
Ed Bruno, member of the United Electrical Workers Union and co-chair of the Labor Party's Workers' Rights Campaign. He spoke with People's Tribune radio correspondent David Apsey at the Labor Party's National Convention held in Washington, D.C. this past July. That's it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
The rich will come down.